Well, welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate. Listeners, there are many diseases and conditions named after the doctors or scientists who identified them. Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, Huntington's, even Crohn's disease, and syndromes, Down syndrome, Ray syndrome. These may be familiar names to you, but you know, we've never had the opportunity to interview any of those doctors or scientists here on HealthLink On Air, and we do have that opportunity this morning. Dr. Robert Sprinson joins us in the studio this morning. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Tricia.
You're a groundbreaker. I'm going to give listeners some of your credentials. It'll give them a clue as to what it is you do, and this is a huge topic. You're the director of the Velo Cardiofacial Syndrome International Center. You're the director of the Center for Genetic Communicative Disorders and a professor of otolaryngology and professor of pediatrics at Upstate.
Correct.
I hear kids, I hear faces, I hear hearts. I hear all of those together. You've named them all together when they are affecting children and, of course, as they turn into adults, Sprinson syndrome.
Some people call it that. I prefer not to myself.
Oh, you don't? Okay. You call it VCFS?
We call it velocardiofacial syndrome, and just for ease, we call it VCFS.
All right. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what the disorder is and then how we might see it, because I think this will be fascinating to people. Let's compare it to start with Down syndrome, because I think they'll understand that a little better to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Down syndrome, and it's actually a good comparison because Down syndrome is the most common multiple anomaly syndrome in children.
And when you say multiple anomaly?
That means children who have multiple problems, structural, behavioral, developmental. And Down syndrome has a population prevalence, meaning walking around in the general world out there, of maybe one in about 1,500 people. Whereas VCFS is the second most common multiple anomaly syndrome known to scientists, and that's about one in 2,000 people, which makes it quite common among genetic diseases, though thankfully it's still considered to be a rare disease by the CDC because it's less than one in 1,500.
There you go. So the thing is, I'm going to sit here and say to you, if I see someone with Down syndrome, I recognize that they have Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. It's fairly easy to recognize. Is that true with VCFS?
No, it's not. And actually, in Down syndrome, the facial appearance, the height of people, the way they walk and so on is very distinctive. It is very abnormal compared to the general population. Whereas in VCFS, the children do look very typical, meaning that if you lined up a group of people with this syndrome together, you would say, oh, gee, they look like brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. and they resemble each other more than they resemble their own parents or siblings, but they don't look abnormal, and they're very normal-looking people that just have a characteristic facial appearance.
They do. And so you particular, because you work with children with this syndrome all the time, you can look at them and say, yes, he's got it, or yes, she's got it.
I hope to think almost always.
Almost yeah. always. All right. All right. So let's talk about, let's break down the name of it, velocardiofacial. Mm-hmm. Velo.
Velo refers to the velum or the soft palate because almost all of these children, about 75% of them, either have a cleft palate or some other structural abnormality of the palate, sometimes difficult to detect. That causes speech problems in these children. And so these are children who typically have a lot of nasality in their speech, a lot of articulation impairment, and language impairment as well.
Okay, so that's actually where you got your start in all of this too, isn't it?
Correct, because at the time I was sitting as director of a very large craniofacial center down in New York City, and this is where we ascertained these cases.
With children with speech problems.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's the first part, the velo part, cardio, heart.
About 70% of these children have congenital heart disease. Often it's complex congenital heart disease, which is easy to identify, such as tetralogy of Fallot.
Which means?
This is a grouping of symptoms that has to do with both the outflow tracts of the heart and structural defects in the heart. And truncus arteriosus, which is somewhat similar, and interrupted aortic arch. But the most common heart problem is ventricular septal defect.
All right. And they are all congenital heart disease.
They are.
Congenital meaning they're babies who are born with this heart disease. And so I would say, looking back, if a baby was born with congenital heart disease, do they always have VCFS or the other way around?
Well, VCFS is the most common genetic cause of complex congenital heart disease, specifically a type known as conotruncal abnormalities. It's a 15%, for example, of all cases of tetralogy of Fallot. It is 50% of all cases of interrupted aortic arch and more than 50% of all cases of truncus arteriosus. So it is common amongst those populations, but because congenital heart disease is the most common birth defect in humans, about 1 in 400 people, mm-hmm. it's a relatively small percentage of all children with congenital heart disease.
Okay. And then facial, of the VCFS, facial, of course.
When we first described the syndrome back in 1978, in the title of the article, we cited children who had problems with the palate and problems with the heart, and the word that we used specifically was and typical facial appearance. So we didn't say it was abnormal. We just said it was typical, and that it is.
And actually, I spent some time looking at pictures of children who have VCFS, and you're right. I mean, it's a very normal-looking face, but when you put them together, they do look like brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And I think that we should tell listeners we're going to put one of those pictures on our website so they can go and look and see for themselves at healthlinkonair.org. All right, so you keep mentioning 1978, and I actually find this is a fascinating part of the story. It's when you started working with VCFS, but I think we should also mention that there's a physical reason why it really wasn't identified before then. Babies didn't live long enough to be identified.
Most of the children who had the medical issues associated with the syndrome, specifically the congenital heart disease, early on in the 1960s, early 1970s, many were not surviving. And so the opportunity to see a large number of these patients in one place was probably limited. There are reports in the literature, however, of cases like this that appeared in the Eastern European literature going back to 1955.
Really?
They were just not identified as a genetic syndrome. They were just interesting case reports in the Czechoslovakian literature of all places.
Yeah. Very interesting. But then, of course, there were new technology came about, new medicines and so forth in the 1970s, earlier 1970s, that these babies were born with congenital heart defects and they did live longer.
Yes. Beginning in the late 70s and early 80s, new medications and new surgical techniques came along. These children were almost always surviving congenital heart disease surgery. And in fact, the rate of survival for these complex congenital heart disease amongst people with VCFS is the same as it is in the general population, which means well over 90% of these children were surviving even very severe congenital heart problems. And that's when the population prevalence started to rise.
So it's we can look at numbers and we can say all of a sudden there were so many more children, quote unquote, being diagnosed. But it's not necessarily because there were more children who had it. It's because more of them were surviving long enough to be diagnosed.
It was that. And also, I think because the syndrome isn't unusual looking per se, it was not easy for people to detect in pediatric units and intensive care units. It really wasn't until 1992, when we understood the genetics of the syndrome, that a lot of excitement started to develop around it, and that's when there was an explosion of publications and interest from the scientific community in the syndrome.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. I mean, beginning in the early 1990s, we were really beginning to better understand how genetics played a role. I mean, we knew that it did, but we didn't understand so much how, and that really had a huge change in the work you were doing.
Absolutely. In 1992, we were able to first report that we found what's known as a microdeletion, a small deletion of DNA from chromosome 22 in our patients. And we published that in The Lancet, which is a very well-known medical journal. And followed that with many reports after that in terms of dissecting just exactly what the problem was in the genome. In that same year, in 1992, we reported a high frequency of mental illness associated with this syndrome. And we found that a very high percentage of our patients, compared to the general population, were developing schizophrenia or psychosis. At that time, one of the major research emphases in the NIH and other places was trying to understand the genetics of mental illness. And so all of a sudden, everything just sort of took off. It really became a hot area for research and a hot area for federal funding.
So if I understand correctly, the fact that now you could identify this, and you would say that every one of your VCF patients had this missing part of their DNA?
Yes.
Okay. And if there wasn't anything missing, then they didn't have VCFS?
Correct.
So you could, that was the one-on-one correlation.
Absolutely.
All right, were they all missing the same amount of DNA or the identical parts of the DNA?
In almost all cases, the break points where the DNA is lost is identical in about 92 to 93% of cases. In the balance of the cases, the break point closer to the top of the chromosome is identical for everybody, but there is a smaller deletion, about half the size of the typical deletion. Though for all practical purposes, the cases look very, very similar.
They did. And could you do a one-on-one correlation with the amount that was missing versus the problems, the physical problems and the mental and emotional problems they ran into?
We're actually still working on that.
And, you are.
Yeah, so we're...
You need more funding then.
we do need more funding, but we are funded right now by the National Institutes of Health to look at this. And we have collaborators here at Upstate, Dr. Wendy Cates in the Department of Psychiatry, Dr. Frank Middleton in neuroscience, who also runs our genomics core. And we're collaborating with a number of institutions down in New York City and a variety of other places as well. So we are still funded to find out this correlation about the number of genes that are missing, mm-hmm. which is 40, by the way, mm-hmm. and the expression of the syndrome in each individual who has those 40 missing genes.
You know, one of the points we haven't made yet is the fact that Upstate is like the center of the world as far as the syndrome is concerned, and you are the person who's sort of directing the entire show. And I want to talk about more, but we need to take a break for the news. Would you be able to stay with us?
Oh, absolutely.
Excellent.
My pleasure.
And listeners, we do need to take a break. Please do stay with us through the news. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air on 570 WSYR.